I'm Frank Warren, coming to you live from the West Coast. Tonight I'll be sitting in for Angela. As most of you know, she's had some fairly significant surgery earlier in the week. But don't fret, she came through it with flying colors. She's currently on the mend and will be back in her chair on the 11th of next month. Now that said, I'd like to give a shout out to her. Get well, Ange. We all love you and we miss you. And once again, I really appreciate you giving me the privilege and trusting me to sit in for you. And speaking of Angela, ironically, there was some military aerial activity in the Stephenville area in the beginning of the week, and we posted some of the reports there over at the UFO Chronicle. If we get a minute with tonight's guest, we'll try to talk about that. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone that in addition to streaming live via the Paranormal Radio Network, we also broadcast at UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. Additionally, you can listen on your cell phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the station ID code 2899. One of the things that I find unique about the Paranormal Radio Network is the fact that you can participate in the conversation in real time using the software PalTalk. I like to call it our virtual auditorium or the V-Room. The software downloads in minutes, it's relatively easy to use, let's face it, I can do it, and it enables you to posit questions either to myself or my guest in real time. If you currently don't have PalTalk, you can either Google it or, better yet, go to D. Andrews' site, Eye to the Sky, which is at www.eyetothesky.net, and at the top of the site you'll notice a button that says How to Find a Room in PalTalk. Her hubby David has graciously published a step-by-step procedure of how to download the software and navigate to the show. Speaking of which, let's take a look and see what's going on in the V Room as we speak. Like these guys are ready. Now, I know we're going to get some good questions tonight. However, I'd like you folks in the V Room to hang on a bit until we establish the dialogue. You'll know when. That brings us to tonight's guest. Now, we were scheduled to have veteran researcher Ray Stanford on in order to discuss the recent hoopla concerning the Socorro incident. However, he wasn't able to make it, and thankfully, I was able to pull another ace out of the deck on very short notice. And this gentleman is not only one of the highest caliber in regards to research, he has also played a part in the recent dialogue concerning Socorro. Dr. Kevin Randall has, for more than 35 years, studied the UFO phenomena in all its various incarnations. Having been trained by the Army as a helicopter pilot, intelligence officer, and military policeman, and by the Air Force as both an intelligence and public affairs officer, this provides Kevin with a keen insight into operations and protocols of the military, their investigations into UFOs, and into a phenomenon that has puzzled people for more than a century. Kevin's educational background is as diverse as his military experience. As an undergraduate at the University of Iowa, he studied anthropology. Graduate work included journalism, psychology, and military science at the University of Iowa, California Coast University, and the American Military University. He has both a master and doctoral degree in psychology and a second master degree in the art of military science. During his investigations, Kevin has traveled the United States to interview hundreds of witnesses who were involved in everything from Roswell, New Mexico, or the crash at Roswell, rather, of 1947, to the repeated radar sightings of UFOs over Washington, D.C. in 1952, to the latest of the abduction cases. Kevin was among the first writers to review the declassified Project Blue Book files, among the first to report on animal mutilations and alien abductions. He was the first to report the alien home invasions and among the first to suggest humans working with aliens. Kevin has written extensively on UFOs beginning in 1973 with articles in various national magazines. He has published a multitude of books about UFOs, starting with the UFO Casebook in 1989, and continuing to Roswell Revisited in 2007. His new book, Crash, about, you guessed it, UFO crashes, will be released in 2010. Kevin was away from his UFO studies when he was recalled to active duty with the Army that included a tour in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, and he recently retired from the Army and the Iowa National Guard as a lieutenant colonel. To learn the latest happenings with Kevin, you can visit his blog, A Different Perspective, at kevinrandall.blogspot.com. Kevin, on behalf of our listeners and myself, I want to extend my personal gratitude to you for your service to our country. Thank you, and welcome to the Joyner Report.
Well, thank you.
Of course, you and I talked earlier, and as with Ray, we wanted to focus on the Socorro incident. And, of course, this has come to light again, as it has many, many times since 1964, but this was precipitated by researcher Tony Bregaglia's article that basically called Socorro a hoax. Why don't I let you take that from there and just give me your feelings on Tony's initial article.
Tony suggested hoax because he had discovered a letter, I guess, that Sterling Colgate, who at one time was the president of the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology in Socorro, had sent to Linus Pauling, in which on a handwritten note, Colgate had said that the whole thing there was a hoax. And he based that, Colgate based that, I guess, on some opinion or maybe a rumor he heard, but not on anything definitive. And I think that a lot of people leaped on this and said, oh my God, Linus Pauling and is involved in this in some fashion. But the truth of the matter is, it's a letter to Pauling. Pauling never made any sort of statement about the validity of the Socorro case. And so I kind of looked at that, and I went back and looked the Air Force file, and just read the Air Force file very, very carefully, in fact, and found that in 1964, when Lonnie Zamora, the Socorro policeman who reported the object on the ground and the creatures from it, and it may be important to point out quickly to everyone that this is the only case that's listed as unidentified in the Project Blue Book files in which the creatures from inside the object were reported outside the object. In other words, it's an occupant case.
Correct.
But at the time of the investigation, Jalen Hynek, who was the Air Force consultant to Project Blue Book, as Hector Quintanilla makes very clear in his book, that he was not the Air Force consultant, but he was a consultant of Project Blue Book, and I'm not sure that the distinction is very important. But Hynek looked for anything to suggest a hoax, as did the Air Force investigators, as did the Army investigators who were there, as did the FBI, as did the New Mexico State Police, as did the Socorro Police Department, and they found no evidence for that. Now we come back, we come forward to 2009, and again we're bombarded with this idea it's a hoax, but we still have no evidence for hoax. Everything that they've put forward to suggest hoax simply doesn't do that. And I think Tony based a lot of it on the fact that Hynek mentioned he had found charred cardboard on the site, and this charred cardboard became some kind of a pyrotechnic tube that created the flame that Zamora saw to drag
well,
into
well,
the
let me interrupt you, Kevin. That actually came later. In fact, I'll pause you just for a second and put my
okay.
two cents in. I felt, and of course, as you and I have talked, you know, I'm a cheerleader for Tony Bregaglia. I appreciate the work that he's attempting to do in Roswell. I appreciate his enthusiasm, and he's got a good nose. The problem that I had with Tony's article is he was making a proclamation. I don't personally have, and I don't think most sober researchers have a problem with anybody looking into a hoax notion, even based on this little bit of evidence or that one-liner that was in the letter. You know, there's no problem with anybody looking into that, and in fact, I think you should. I think every stone should be unturned. But the issue was he made a proclamation. He made a statement rather than pose a question, and he caught a lot of flack for that. And of course, it's basically the letter is written hearsay, and then he went and he reinforced it with other people with more oral hearsay. So in essence, there is no evidence, either court and or that would is passable in a court of law, or in the halls of science, That's what I had the big problem with. And of course, now it's turned into a big mucky muck from that point.
I understand what you're saying. And where I was going was that one of the things he used to reinforce this idea that it was a hoax is his burnt or charred cardboard that Hynek had picked up in 1964, suggesting to Tony this was a hoax, but overlooking the fact that Hynek at the time dismissed it as being relevant, that there was an awful lot of cardboard on the site, there was a dump site close at hand, there was cardboard all over the place, and the cardboard was weathered. It had been there for weeks and weeks, if not months and months, gone through, as I think Hynek described it, many rains and drying.
That's correct.
So the cardboard was unimportant, but he used that to reinforce this idea it was a hoax. And when I was looking at the Air Force file and a lot of the other things that I looked at to refresh my mind on the Socorro case, we couldn't find any evidence that supported that. One of the interesting things, Charles Moore, who was our nemesis on the Roswell case,
mm-hmm.
said that he had looked into the idea. He'd been asked by someone whether or not it was a hoax. And he had actually said in a letter to Jim Moseley in 1995, I think it was, there was no evidence of a New Mexico Tech student being involved in any kind of a hoax.
I read the very same letter, and it's important to note his stature there at New Mexico Tech. I mean, he was in equal stature with everyone else there as far as Moore is concerned. And of course, he's the big Roswell debunker. He's the pusher of the mogul notion. So I think that's important to bring that into the fray.
And one other thing is when Hynek was there, and I forget the man's name, who was at that time the president of New Mexico Tech. So Hynek had talked to New Mexico Tech and was told by these guys that the students hadn't been involved. So we can look at it from one point of view, and it's kind of like we get into a trial with experts, the dueling experts. Your expert says what you want him to say. My expert says what I want him to say. But we have a president of New Mexico Tech saying, in conflict with what Sterling Colgate said, this was not a hoax.
Right.
So we have an instructor there who was there for decades saying it's not a hoax. We have a former president saying it's not a hoax. We have no evidence of a hoax being gathered at the time or at the scene. All we have is a statement from Sterling Colgate to Linus Pauling, and of course the fact is to Linus Pauling is irrelevant, saying that he believed it to be a hoax.
Well, I think the other part, one of the things that I discussed with Tony briefly, and of course Ray Stanford literally wrote the book on Socorro. He was heralded by Alan Hynek. In fact, Hynek wrote in a letter to Ray when the book was published. He said, Hynek writes, "The Socorro UFO case is one of the classics in UFO history. In Socorro Saucer in a Pentagon Pantry," which of course is Ray's book, "Ray Stanford not only tells the story well, but has brought to it a great deal of painstaking and intensive research, presenting a far more comprehensive and coherent treatment of this important case. The Socorro case has always been a thorn in the side of UFO detractors who have tried to dismiss it either as a deliberate attempt by the town fathers of Socorro to promote the tourist trade," of course he's talking about class there, or as atmospheric phenomena. "Ray Stanford has shown these attempts to be patently unattainable. Stanford has transformed this case from a one-witness matter to a multi-witness case and has thus accomplished what the Air Force failed to do. In the preparation of his book, Ray Stanford has exhibited a rare persistence in tracking down vital details of this remarkable and pivotal UFO sighting. His enthusiastic dedication and preoccupation with this case has been monumental." And that, of course, that says it all, and coming from Hynek and in terms of the research that Ray did. And he was kind enough to send me one of his books, book in question, several weeks ago, and it's really not even fair to call it a book. This is a very, very thorough report on the events that took place. And people forget, And quite frankly, in talking to Tony, one of the very first things that he should have done had he wanted to look into the case was pick up the phone and call Ray Stanford. Nobody, in my mind, knows the Socorro case as well as Stanford does. But one of the things that he brought out, as Alan Hynek says here, it's a multi-witness case. There were other witnesses to this particular event. Also, Zamora saw the blue flame in the air. In other words, he didn't just come upon it was on the ground. He actually saw it as it was coming down. In addition to that, in the year of 1964, there were multiple events and other cases of either elliptical shape or egg-shaped objects, including other landings. And most recently, I found one in that predated the Zamora case. It was an Air Force report that's in the Blue Book files with photographs, and in fact we have some of it posted at the UFO Chronicles, that showed an elliptical or egg-shaped object over Roswell the month before the Zamora case. So you've got multiple events, you've got multiple witnesses. The Air Force, by the way, looked into that, looked into some of these other cases. And then you have physical evidence that was tested at the site. You have evidence that indicates mass. You have two types of propulsion systems based on the eyewitness testimony, and then you have the object leaving the area what some would measure at supersonic speeds, and the whole event took place in a matter of minutes. This is supposed to be a hoax.
You had Lonnie Zamora, of course, seeing the object on the ground by himself, but within minutes of the thing taking off, there were other state policemen. Sam Chavez was there within a minute and a half, so that even though he didn't see the object, had there been hoaxers in the area, they should have been able to see them fleeing the scene.
Certainly.
Because they clearly didn't take off in the object, whatever it was, if there were hoaxers.
True. That's exactly true.
And as we're talking about this, something else popped into my mind, talking about an egg-shaped craft. There was, of course, the Levelland sightings in November of 1957. And I bring this up only because the Air Force investigated that. Donald Kehoe, who was the director of NICAP at the time, said there were nine witnesses to the object at Levelland, Texas. The Air Force responded and said, and virtually called Kehoe a liar and said, no, there were only three witnesses. Kehoe, we don't know what Kehoe's talking about. Turns out both of them are wrong, because I went back to the Air Force files and other stuff and identified witnesses at 13 separate locations that talked about this thing. The Air Force only interviewed three witnesses, and if they didn't talk to a witness, that witness did not exist, even though had they done basic research or investigation, they would have been able to find witnesses at 13 separate locations. So Kehoe was wrong. His number was too low. And now we have the same thing going on at Socorro. They're doing everything they can to explain this case. And in 1995, they came out with the idea that it was a lunar lander, possibly that had strayed off White Sands, because they found there had been some testing of the lunar lander earlier that morning. But what they never tell you is the lunar lander in those tests was tethered to the ground. It couldn't have drifted literally miles and miles to Socorro to land and take off at 5 o'clock in the evening or 6 o'clock in the evening.
Right. I think, in fact, you're talking about the lunar lander in general. Like you, I was reviewing some of the Blue Book files and the investigations that were going on. There was an extensive investigation. In fact, I was trying to count all of the companies that the Air Force reached out to specifically investigate what type of equipment they were using in regards to any space and or moon projects. They spent a lot of energy trying to find a craft that would fit into what Lonnie Zamora had seen, and they came up, as we all know, with zilch. They could not find a conventional explanation.
And let's point out something here. Everybody, and we're doing the same thing. Everybody is talking as if Zamora saw something real. We're not suggesting it was an illusion, it was a hallucination, it was a delusion. We all agree Lonnie Zamora saw something real.
That's correct.
And
yeah.
Lonnie Zamora was telling the truth in describing this object as best he could, which doesn't necessarily mean it was extraterrestrial, but it means that everybody accepts the idea that Lonnie Zamora was an honest police officer whose career was virtually destroyed by this, because later on, whenever he'd go to court, for whatever reason, the people would say, oh, you can't believe anything he says, he sees flying saucers, and eventually resigned from the police department because of this.
Well, and I think, well, on the positive note, back to his character, that was uniform across the board. All the military factions agreed on that. Nobody disputed Lonnie's testimony and or his character. And, and that's a big pat on the back, I think, for the man himself.
Oh, absolutely. But that's the point. We all are discussing this with the basic assumption that Lonnie Zamora saw something on the ground. So the question becomes, was it extraterrestrial? Was it some kind of secret test equipment? And what would that equipment be that was tested in 1964 that we wouldn't know about today in 2009? Or was it a hoax? But he saw something and reported accurately what he had seen.
Correct, yeah. Well, and then, of course, back to, in fact, ironically, even Lincoln LaPaz commented on Lonnie's character and what an astute observer he was, because he had actually witnessed a meteor that LaPaz was looking into years before. So he had met Lonnie Zamora and commented on his character. But back to the witness thing again. Prior to Zamora seeing it, we have the tourists, the family that was driving into Socorro that witnessed the object, and they conveyed that to Opal Grinder, the owner of the gas station.
And isn't that a marvelous name, Opal Grinder?
Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't have planned that. Hynek actually put up a reward to try to find that family, which he wasn't successful. However, Opal Grinder did sign an affidavit to what she heard the family say, and they witnessed the object at low altitude fly right over their car, and he commented to Opal Grinder, "You sure have strange things flying awful low around here." And they also witnessed simultaneously Lonnie in pursuit of presumably the young man, in hot pursuit of the car. And so they saw that and the object as it was heading over in the direction of where Zamora was. The other thing that gets overlooked, now those were visual witnesses. There were many people in the aftermath that actually heard the loud roar. In fact, from what I've read, there were hundreds that heard it. So they were audio witnesses. And a lot of people ask, well, what, if they didn't see it, what's the big deal? Well, it reinforces the timeline. So it is, in my view, it's an important component of the preponderance of the totality of the evidence in that regard. Then, of course, you have the other two witnesses, the Iowans, that went on record and also said they saw it. There was a little blurb written on them in one of the Iowa newspapers.
The Dubuque Herald, I actually have a copy of the article.
Oh, do you? I'd like to get a copy of that. I was looking for that.
$800 in a year.
I was going to give you $850.
Yeah, well, hey, you saved yourself $50. What can I say?
Well, as I mentioned to you before the show, I was able to locate one of those witnesses. Now, I haven't talked to him yet, and hopefully he will.
They have been dismissed, and I've never been sure whether the dismissal of these two guys was legitimate or not.
Mm-hmm.
A fellow here in Iowa apparently talked to him and said he didn't believe their story because it didn't track with what Lonnie Zamora said. And I don't know what they may have said to him that made him think that.
Mm-hmm.
But that and another rumor that the mayor of Socorro owned the land where the thing landed is something that permeated this whole case since Phil Klass got involved in it. But there are those two guys as well, and what's valuable about them is not like the Opal Grinder witnesses, who we don't know. These guys are named, and we know where they are, or we knew where they are.
Right.
So we've got named witnesses who also claim to have seen the thing. So it's not just Lonnie Zamora, although Lonnie Zamora is the only one to have seen the occupants of it and see it on the ground, but we have two named witnesses who also claim to have seen it.
Well, and since Lonnie's recent passing, in talking to Ray Stanford, he shared with me that he felt that Chavez may have seen the craft take off. He felt that he had got there in time and felt that he actually may have witnessed the craft take off and I forget which direction, but going over the mountains, which I find quite interesting. Of course, Chavez is no longer with us.
Well, we should point out that taking off into the wind, which kind of rules out a balloon.
Yeah, it was a very, very, very windy day, which the other, in terms of the landing gear imprints, for lack of a better term, the imprints, in terms of the investigators that came up on the scene and the ones that made the photographs, the FBI guy that made the photographs that day, there was talk that, in other words, these weren't dug. It was compressed. So the object had mass. It had tremendous mass to it. And anything in regards to a balloon, obviously, you could figure out the lift in terms of helium and that kind of thing. If it was a balloon, it would have to have been tethered in some way, particularly because it was so windy. So a balloon that was tethered, blowing in the wind, to me that would have just been obvious, very obvious. And, of course, any pyrotechnics and that kind of thing, anybody that's been to a 4th of July display knows the aftermath of fireworks and the smell and the odor that's there, aside from the fact that the ground and the bushes were tested.
Well, and there's a lot of smoke too with the detonation of the pyrotechnics.
And there was no smoke. Yeah, that is the other important thing to remember.
And one thing I've heard a number of the skeptics say, well, the landing gear was asymmetrical, and this doesn't make sense to them. And of course, first of all, we can always say, well, we don't know what an alien mind would do, but I don't know of anybody who has actually tried to fit the landing gear markings on the terrain, meaning it's not adjusted for the terrain. It's not a flat surface the thing landed on. It's an arroyo. So the landing gear may, in fact, have been symmetrical. It's just it didn't look symmetrical based on the terrain upon which it landed. But it seems that the flame that came out of it came out of what would have been considered the center of mass of the object, which suggests the landing gear did what it was supposed to do, hold the thing upright and stable.
Correct, yeah. Well, and that's an interesting point, the fact that the uneven terrain and so forth and so on. It would be an engineer's nightmare, really, the way that this thing was set up. Also, and of course, the landing site was well documented, and it was interesting to note that, according to Hynek, the photographs from the FBI agent, I don't recall his name.
I think it was Burns, but I'm not sure.
The one that was there that day, that evening, when they took the first photographs, according to Hynek, they were fogged as if by radiation, that they did not come through. And even I was reading Menzel's letter to Hynek, and he referred to photographs. And I was wondering if he was talking about the first set of photographs or the photographs that were taken later when Hynek was there. Of course, by the time Hynek got there, the site was contaminated.
It was 4 days or 2 days?
I think it was 4 days.
4 days, 4 days.
Yeah, I think he got there. The incident happened on the 24th. I think he was there on the 29th, if I'm not mistaken.
And the thing about it is, Menzel is the one that originally made a big deal of the cardboard, and,
yes,
and noted that Hynek had said in his report that there was charred cardboard. He was asking all kinds of questions about this charred cardboard, if it was had some significance. And Hynek, of course, responded, "Well, no, it was. There's a lot of it around there. I just happened to pick this up." And I tried to make the point that the only importance of the cardboard is it happened to be there on the site, but it has nothing to do with the sighting. So
you have to get the flavor of the arroyo and that in the area at the time. It's very well documented in Ray's book. He paints the picture well in terms of debris and trash and paper and so forth. And some of it was in fact burned. And quite frankly, Ray actually supplied the containers to Hynek when they picked up the paper and cardboard.
And the other thing that Hynek says in his report back to Quintanilla at Blue Book is the next time he's on the side, he'll pick up some of the cardboard and send it to Menzel, so he'll know what it looks like.
Right.
So not only, they didn't gather all the cardboard, they picked up a representative sample, but when they tested the soil samples, they found nothing unusual about the soil. No evidence of pyrotechnics, no evidence of chemicals, no evidence of radiation.
Jet fuel.
And any kind of chemical
exactly.
On the site. So it eliminates a number of the explanations that way. And when I mentioned on my blog what it said in that, they said, well, the pyrotechnics were set off at a different location, which now means we've got at least four people involved in this hoax. The speeder who drew Zamora into the area, who committed a felony by running from the police,
right.
The guy who set off the pyrotechnics, and the two guys who were running around pretending to be aliens before they vanished from the scene, or as somebody said, pole vaulted out of the area so they didn't leave a lot of footprints.
Yeah, I told Tony, I said, if there are some students who can perform a hoax of this caliber and can build a craft that has a dual propulsion system, one silent at one point, and that can zip off and be out of sight in a matter of minutes, they needed to go over to White Sands. Perhaps we could have got on the moon 5-6 years earlier. the whole idea is just absolutely ludicrous.
And Tony pointed me to a website and said, here's a website of this secret society at New Mexico Tech where they did a lot of these hoaxes, and I'm thinking, secret society with a website? And if I understood the website right, these guys weren't there until like 1984.
Right.
So anything they did in creating hoaxes at New Mexico Tech is pretty much irrelevant.
Well, and there again, that goes back to hearsay, I was very disappointed with the initial article and the second article, and quite frankly, when the third article came up, I didn't even read it. I scanned it, and I just thought, oh my God, we've got, come on, Tony, you at least address some of the facts. You can't, he went through and he's ignored the scientific evidence that's been culled at the time from people that were there, and he's heralding this hearsay. It was just poor research, I thought, and I'd hoped. When he got to the third article, I just couldn't believe it. But, to shift gears just for a minute, one thing that has come up in since Lonnie has passed is the symbol itself. This has intrigued many. And in fact, over the years, even if you skip what has gone on lately with the student prank, of course, the other more plausible notion of a conventional explanation has been if it was some sort of conventional craft for the moon landing or some sort of experimental craft, and people have focused on that on the symbol that Lonnie recorded. Now, when Lonnie died, Ray had come up and highlighted the fact that the initial reports, there's some contrasting arguments in exactly what he saw. And in fact, we published one the other day from one of the AP articles where the symbol is a little bit different than what he had signed his name to. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm bothered by the fact that we have a look of what the symbol was in 1964. We've got Lonnie Zamora signing the illustrations, and you've seen those signatures as well as I have in the Air Force file. And now suddenly Lonnie Zamora has died, and we have a new symbol that there's no way to verify if this new symbol is accurate or not. Hynek might have known it, but Hynek's dead. I have not attempted to find the FBI agent. If if he's still around from that time frame. But I'm just bothered by the new number of symbols. And you know, of course, in the Air Force file, there were a number of different organizations who had symbols that sort of represented or sort of resembled what Lonnie had drawn.
There were. I've seen some of those, and of course that's intriguing. Something that Ray threw out that I thought was interesting, and it's plausible to a certain degree, he thought, and this is a theory, this is speculation, but he thought perhaps Holder, and of course one thing we do know is that Lonnie was told not to talk about the symbol, and for that matter, not to talk about the little guys. But he felt that Holder drew the symbol, and that they did not want to show the actual symbol in the event that there was another sighting, and if somebody mentioned the symbol or drew another symbol, if they had put out the bogus one, and then somebody drew a symbol with another sighting, and it happened to be the real one, then they would, in fact, that would shore up that case, and they would feel that it would be authentic. And I thought, well, that's kind of a good idea, if in fact that's the case. I don't have, my personal thought is that they didn't know what was going on, so the less details out in the public domain, the better. Don't talk about the little guys. Don't talk about the symbols. You know, none of the specifics.
Well, the one thing I'll say from my experience as an intelligence officer is simply you give out, you try not to share information with anybody outside your organization, which means I would brief our soldiers on everything that they needed to know. And I actually happened one day. I got a phone call from a newsman, and he wanted me to confirm something. I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I knew exactly what he was talking about. But I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, well, you're not very good at your job. And I'm thinking, yeah, I got you fooled. Holder's the captain that came from White Sands, the Army officer, right?
Correct, yeah.
And that sounds like something that an intelligence officer or an FBI agent would come up with. Let's not talk about this aspect of it. Let's hold something back so that we can validate other information if we get it in.
Yeah, and I think that's plausible. And the other thing that shores some of that up, in terms of the different symbol, and that's at the UFO Chronicles. They did early on, before there was the lid was clamped down. There was an artist. Her name is at our site, and she drew her interpretation based on Zamora's testimony, according to this AP article, and it was not what he signed his name to, that presumably, as according to Ray, was written by Holder. So you have that early on. You have the discrepancy there. Which I find is interesting, but the symbol is very, very intriguing to me.
And we have very few UFO sightings that aren't hoaxes that have any kind of symbols involved. And I think of
it makes me think of Rendlesham,
Spain, when they had the big thing painted underneath the UFO that got a lot of play in the 70s. So we don't have a lot of that sort of thing, that there's any kind of symbols on the object. But there was also a letter in the Air Force file, as I'm sure you know, where they had sent a letter to the FBI and asked about the designation of numbers on airplanes, which we pilots know are called the N number. And is there anything else that they might put on an airplane? Of course, a corporation would put its logo on it. But the FBI said, well, you've got to have this registration number on it. Period. End of discussion. So, you know, we look at the investigation done by the Air Force, and they went to that much trouble to contact the FAA to find out whether or not this symbol was anything that they might have been responsible for.
Right, right. Well, I have been derelict in duty here, and I have been ignoring the V room. And let me pull some questions here. Since we only have an hour, and time is running short. Let me look here and see if we have some good questions. Well, one in particular is someone asks, what has Lonnie Zamora said about the incident to anyone in recent years? I know some researchers that have attempted to see him. In fact, they've gone to Socorro, and he was standoffish. He, towards the end of it, or from my perspective, he really didn't want to talk about it. What are your thoughts, Kevin?
I used to work with a fellow named Robert Cornett, and Cornett and I, of course, had an interest in astronomy as well, so he was in Socorro to go visit the very large array of the radio telescope out between Socorro and Dattles. And he noticed Lonnie Zamora's name in the phone book and gave him a call. And Zamora says, well, we're about to have a barbecue, and you're welcome to come over and join us if you don't talk about the flying saucers. So he didn't want to talk about it. And when this whole thing began, when Tony first published his article, I was composing a letter to Zamora to ask him some questions by repeating that anecdote and seeing if I could get him to correspond with me a little bit. Fortunately, I had not sent the letter.
Yeah.
But it's too bad also that we've lost that opportunity to ask him some specific questions now about that. But you're right. He was very standoffish and didn't want to talk about the flying saucer landing.
Well,
after
I think the initial burst of
fame, I guess.
Well, yeah, and it's important to note too, particularly for people that are coming to the table now. I mean, this went around the world. This was a big thing. In fact, it precipitated many sightings in the western states in 1964. He was inundated with people, and of course in 1964, and then over the years, and then it would get revitalized at different times. Of course, we're seeing that now.
Well, Bill Brazel said something to me once. Bill Brazel is the son of the rancher who found the debris field in Roswell. And he said that periodically, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd get a phone call from a drunk wanting to know if what he'd said about the UFO was true. and I'm thinking, you know, and not just that, but then you get all the phone calls from the UFO investigators, or the people who are just interested in wanting to find out whether the information that's been published is true. And I certainly understand that, because I've done the same thing.
Right.
But then you end up with literally hundreds of people calling this guy, and it might work out to one or two phone calls a year, but it does get old pretty quick.
Right. Well, and he did, to his credit, he did cooperate with the UFO hunters.
Yeah,
they did do an episode on that, and of course I'm not a big fan of UFO hunters, but I was glad to see him at least participate.
Well, now I have to say I was a big fan of UFO hunters because I met John Greenwald when I was at the MUFON convention in Denver, and he's a nice fellow.
Yeah, well, we all want to adopt John. Well, no, that was one of the positive notes out of UFO hunters. Quite frankly, hopefully, I know a good friend and colleague, Dwayne Tootle, is trying to put something together. And, of course, he and John worked together on UFO Files, which I was a fan of. I really thoroughly enjoy both of their work, and hopefully something can come about on that. But I just thought it was interesting that Zamora did, you know, that was, I guess, his last hurrah, so to speak, before
he
passed away.
Well, if you saw the sightings did something in the mid-90s.
I actually have that clip at the UFO Chronicles. We've got
which
YouTube
is interesting
clip.
Because I'm on it.
Yeah.
And I had forgotten about that, but it came out, they did that in like 1995, and it was just about the time the Air Force had began talking of the lunar lander explanation. And so they came out and we did like 3 or 4 different cases at one time, and we're out in my backyard, we're downstairs in my library, we're all kinds of places, so we've got different, so they can plug it into different clips, and it doesn't look like we did it all
at one time.
Could
use that to sell your house?
Pardon me?
I said you could use that clip to sell your house.
Well, no, you couldn't see the house because it's in the backyard, but it's we had a couple of fruit trees back there, so it's, well, anyway. But all we do really talk about is the lunar lander. But what's interesting, and I meant to bring this up earlier, was that clip seemed to have inspired somebody who lived out in California who had been there in the days after the sighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Zamora or one of the police officers took him out to the site, so you've got their filming of the site within days.
Right.
And you can see some of the debris scattered around on the site.
Right, yeah. And well, and that's important, which is the other thing. I mean, it's important to take note of the people that were there at the time. And let's don't forget Coral Lorenzen was there on site within days.
No, she was there. She beat Hynek and some of the military there.
Yeah, exactly.
I got the impression they were there the same night.
Well, I don't think Coral was. No, she was there a couple. In fact, that one picture of her, I think that was the next day, because she's in the picture when they have the...
Well, she beat the Air Force there.
Yeah, no, she did. That's correct.
And the Air Force was, or somebody was commenting about the fact that the Lorenzens, I guess her husband was with her too, they lived in Alamogordo at the time.
Yes.
Which is just down the road from Socorro.
Yes. And she shows up in one of the pictures, which I think was the Saturday. Now, the event took place on Friday. I believe she was there Saturday, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not going to argue with you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I got the impression she was there that evening, but it may have been the next day.
Well, I'm going by the picture, but perhaps she was there that night. But there is a picture.
But the Air Force commented, or somebody commented, the fact that she got there before the Air Force got there to investigate.
Huh. Well, that could be true.
I think Ray got there with Hynek. I mean, not that he traveled with him, but at the same time, Hynek got there.
Yeah, yes. They both they got there on the 29th.
Yeah,
I believe. And then they went out to the site together. Let me. I've got another question here from Dee. And fast question. She says, "What did the symbol that Zamora saw look like?" I've heard several different descriptions, so I don't know what is real. And that's interesting. Let me see if I can describe that real quick. You don't have that in front of you.
Well, what it looked like was an inverted V with a line down the center of it, a straight line underneath it, and an umbrella shape above it.
Right.
Is what is in the Air Force file and what Lonnie Zamora drew. The later symbols are like three or four inverted Vs with lines across them of different colors.
Well, now I'm looking at the other symbol.
Okay.
It's an inverted V with three lines going across it. And now, we've got this on site at the UFO Chronicles, and this was taken. This was an artist's conception, and it was from 1964, I think it was within the week, and it says, "This drawing is an artist's conception of the unidentified flying object seen in the last week in New Mexico. It was made from newspaper accounts of six persons who say they saw the craft." Now, that I found interesting all by itself.
Yes.
That they mention six individual witnesses that mention the symbol. So that's another little twist to the story, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see here. I'm trying to get some more questions in here. What has Lonnie Zamora said about the incident to anyone in recent years? We discussed that. I don't want to ignore anybody. Let's see if we have anybody. Let's see here. Dee, I know you're listening. I've got about six things going on here. If you see some pertinent questions, go ahead and shoot them to me. Kevin, we're coming up to the end of our hour here.
Yeah, I see that.
Boy, that went by fast, didn't it? Let me see if I can squeeze in one more question. Looks like we're still stuck on...
And I could just talk about anything to keep the air from going dead.
Yes, you certainly
but
could.
I hear you mumbling in the background. Yeah, I got questions here, and I'm going...
Yeah, while I do a jig here.
Dead air is a bad thing to have on the radio.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? Because we're about to, we've got to sign off here. Why don't we give us a quick plug about your book and about the website and what's going on with Kevin Randle.
Well, Crash will be coming out in the spring of 2010. It's a long, in-depth look at UFO crashes from the Middle Ages up through 2009. And so we try to provide information about all of these things. I don't believe they're falling out of the sky with quite the numbers that people are talking about. But looking at all this stuff, but looking at some of the good ones, including Roswell, Shag Harbor, Kecksburg, those sorts of things. Zocoro doesn't figure in this because it's not a crash, it's a landing.
Mm-hmm.
And you've mentioned, my blog is called A Different Perspective. If you type in A Different Perspective UFO, you'll get to it right away. And it's at www.kevinrandle.blogspot.com. And my last name is spelled R-A-N-D-L-E, Candle, instead of the conventional spelling. And I, like you mentioned earlier, I've retired from the National Guard, and they send me money each month for not showing up, which I think is a really fine deal.
Well, I'm at your blog all the time, and I certainly enjoy it, Kevin. And listen, I really appreciate you coming on the show with me on such short notice, and as we knew it would, the hour just went by in a blink of an eye. So we've got to sign off here. I also want to extend my sincere appreciation to Angela for entrusting me with her baby again. I really do appreciate the privilege, Angela. And we want you to get better soon. I know you're on the mend and everything went okay. And for your regular listeners, you will be back here on the 11th. And for Joe and the Paranormal Radio Network, and don't forget, we're also broadcasting live at UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'd like to bid everybody a good night, and thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you.
Good night.